That was the first time anybody had ever done that for me. It was a massive moment. Oh, I'm included. Or my experience of this is included. And the Bible's got useful stuff to say into that area of life. So for those two reasons, preparing people to live in culture and the fact that within an average church, there will be those for whom this is an issue. Churches can't be silent.
Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. Great to be with you for another episode. My name is Adrian Reynolds, Head of National Ministries for the FIEC, and I'm here with Andy Robinson. Hello, Andy.
Lovely to be with you, Adrian.
I learned when we did a previous episode that you're from Manchester, so welcome to the South, otherwise known as Market Harbour, FIEC Towers. It's great to have you with us. And we're here to talk specifically about how we care in church for people with same-sex attraction. Now, I'm slightly nervous about this because I'm nervous about language and things like that. So, first of all, you work 2 days a week for Living Out, which is an organisation that helps the church think about just this issue. Think about some of the theological issues as well as the pastoral issues. Just to be clear, we're not going to do theological issues particularly today. We're going to save that for another podcast. But we are here to talk about pastoral issues, how we care for people, which is part of shepherding. It's part of leading, isn't it?
Yeah.
To care for all those that the Lord has given us. So just lay out some of the landscape for us and just help me to start off with. I'm talking about same-sex attraction. Is that the best language to be using?
Yeah, and people do use various language. So so at Living Out, Living Out's a group of Christian leaders who experience same-sex attraction themselves, committed to a biblically orthodox view on sexuality. So that's the story of all of us who are involved in it. So part of it would be, what language would I want to use to describe myself?
Right.
Often I will use the language of, I'm a Christian who experiences same-sex attraction. And the reason I will often put it like that is it's an identity marker. So the main thing about me is that I'm a Christian, want to live with Jesus Lord, child of God. And another true aspect of my experience is that pretty much since teenage years, my attractions have been towards other guys. And so I will use it just as a description of my experience of life. It's worth saying, in some contexts, same-sex attraction can feel quite weird and clunky language.
Is it only Christians who use it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Which is not in itself a bad thing.
No.
Because the other language presumably is very loaded in the culture we live in.
I think the tricky thing is, language is loaded pretty much whatever language you use.
Right,
so particularly in the States, actually, people often like avoiding same-sex attraction because it tends to have a history of being used by those who try to change people's sexuality and sometimes would use coercive means to do that. So in the States, same-sex attraction comes with that sort of baggage.
So the sort of conversion stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
The conversion therapy stuff, yeah.
Obviously, the alternative language tends to be using gay language. Sometimes people will want to avoid gay language because it implies you're positive about having a gay relationship. It comes with a whole load of identity stuff as to, this is the essence of who I am. So the really cheerful news is most language is tricky on this.
Yes, thank you.
So part of me wants to say, relax.
Although it's interesting because a lot of church leaders will say most language is tricky. So I'm just going to go for silence.
Yeah.
So you're saying relax. I think there will be a whole group of church leaders who think silence actually is a safer option. And we've got to talk about this stuff, haven't we?
We've got to talk about this for two or three reasons. I mean, one is because it is a massive cultural issue.
So
if you don't talk about this within church, you are not equipping the church to live within the culture at all. I think churches have got to speak about this. But I think the second reason churches have got to speak about this is because within an average-sized church, there will probably be two or three people for whom same-sex attraction is a personal issue. And one of the key moments for me growing up, certainly as a student last century, was actually a pre-
It really was last century.
It really was last century.
I don't want to make you feel bad.
No,
about it,
really I've done the math.
You and me both. Yeah. Bro, you and me both.
But a vital moment for me was a preacher, it was actually in a Christian Union meeting, actually, making an application into sexuality for those in the group who would struggle with that. That was the first time anybody had ever done that for me. And it was a massive moment. Oh, I'm included. Or my experience of this is included. And the Bible's got useful stuff to say into that area of life. So for those two reasons, preparing people to live in culture and the fact that within an average church, there will be those for whom this is an issue, churches can't be silent. I think probably same-sex attraction language is probably the safest to use, but I wouldn't be dogmatic about saying that is the language everybody has to use.
Well, let's stick with it for
now. That's fine.
Verb to use. So I've often say wrestle with, battle with. That's quite combative. Is that unhelpful? You just said experience. Is that a better verb?
I mean, experience.
Just help me out there.
Yeah, experience is the language I tend to use. Partly because there's no value judgment attached to it. So, yeah, I'm conscious that amongst the people I'm speaking to will be non-Christians who will take a different view to me on this. I'm probably, in a sense, using battle, wrestle. It immediately implies this is something negative and almost distasteful. So I just use experience as neutral language, partly to help me talk to non-Christians, really.
So language can be very pejorative, can't it? We've talked about that before when it comes to singleness, and we've got to be careful with language, I think.
Yeah, I mean, again, part of me doesn't want to leave people feeling unduly burdened, but experience can be a useful word in this context.
Sure. Now, let's talk about some of the statistics. Mm. Because I think one of the things that perhaps people, especially from an older generation, may feel is that we've been bombarded with this all the time. You know, if we watch an advert, there's always a same-sex couple in an advert, for example, or a TV drama, or even period dramas. You know, it's written back into sort of period dramas. So when it comes to sort of, when it comes to prevalence of same-sex attraction, what sort of levels are we talking about? I think there's a sense in which you might watch the media and think it's kind of 10-15% of the population. Is that right, or is that just a misreading of the situation?
Yeah, I mean, within the media, it is exaggerated as to the prevalence. I think in the census that came out recently, which was the first census that invited people to identify their sexuality. Yeah. From memory, I think it comes out about 1.5-2%.
Okay, so perhaps lower than people might think.
So it is lower. So most dramas will have an over-representation of gay, same-sex attracted couples within them. But obviously, you know, 1.5-2% is not an insignificant number when you think about also needing to do pastoral care within an average church.
Sure. And I guess there's another chunk of the population who would describe sexuality is fluid. You were saying to me before we came on air, that's probably more to do with a cultural thing than a reality. Just unpack that a little bit for me.
So as I talked to teenagers, funnily enough, I was speaking to teenagers on this last night, their experience of what it is to be a teenager is so different to what mine was 25 years ago. So I think to be same-sex attracted in my generation, that people didn't experiment, you know, by and large, those who identified as such, that was reasonably likely to be their long-term position. As I talk to teenagers today, there seems to be a greater sense of a kind of fluidity whereby people, well, let's experiment and see what works best for me in a way that was very different to a generation ago. And so I'm just conscious, again, generationally, there's a massive difference on this. I don't think there's a huge amount of fluidity amongst those who are sort of my age and older. I think if you go younger, there is much more a sense of people talking about fluidity, experimentation, and so on. So there's quite a generational difference on this as well.
Right. Now, let's talk about pastoral theology. Mm. And I guess especially we need to distinguish, don't we, between how we are dealing with folk who are believers and those who are not.
Yeah, I
think there is again, perhaps it's a generational thing to some extent, but I think all of us have this deep in our hearts, really, that when we see people who are following sinful lifestyles of any kind, in fact, and they're not believers, our initial reaction is always to fix that. You know, we see someone come into church, perhaps they're dressed in a certain way that goes against our culture, or they're living a certain way, and, you know, we think, we've got to fix that, and, you know, and then bring them to Christ. We've got to see the primacy of the gospel when dealing with those who are not believers, right?
Absolutely. So if you look at Romans 1, for instance, homosexual practice or approval of homosexual practice. In Romans 1, that's a symptom of a problem rather than the cause of it.
Right.
So in Romans 1, human beings don't glorify God nor give thanks to him. As a result, God hands us over to a whole heap of things, including homosexual behavior and approval of it. So it seems to me in Romans 1, that's a symptom of a problem rather than the cause of it. The problem is, as human beings, we don't give thanks to God nor glorify him as God. And so certainly in our culture today, people are not going to change their view on sexuality, it seems to me, actually, unless they get converted, unless they come back to God, unless they hear the gospel. And it's worth saying, isn't it, that the antidote to homosexual practice in Romans is the gospel. You know, it is the gospel of Christ crucified and the work of the Spirit. And if I'm honest, I suspect we've made some missteps over the years in thinking that we can run campaigns on this divorced from the gospel and think those will get traction.
Yeah, okay.
And let's be honest.
That is really helpful.
We haven't done, really.
We're going through a series, a very short series, in Jonah at the moment at church. Mm. It's very striking, Jonah chapter 4, how angry Jonah gets because God shows mercy, not judgment.
Yeah.
I think it's a very current word to us. Mm. Really, I mean, it always has been, I think, that we, inside of God's people, we look at those outside and we see sin for what it is. That's right. Mm. We see God's judgment against sin as being a terrible but necessary thing. That's right. And we're a bit like Jonah. We get so angry we could die. We wish that God's judgment would come down rather than God's mercy.
Yeah.
And actually that compassion that we need to show for the lost needs to extend to people, even whose lifestyles,
absolutely,
in all kinds of different ways, we might find distasteful or difficult or whatever else it may be. And we've got to teach our folk that, haven't we? We've got to teach them that God is a God of compassion towards those deserving of judgment.
Yeah.
He delights to show mercy, and we must too.
Absolutely. And it's interesting in the light of debates going on within certain parts of the church at the moment. As you look at 1 Corinthians 5...
Yeah, it was very coy, by the way, certain parts of the church. We all know what you're talking about. This is an FIC podcast. We can just say certain parts of the church, that's fine.
I've been well trained. But you have Paul in 1 Corinthians arguing desperately for the purity of the church, and at the same time, you know, saying there are certain professing believers you're not to associate with because of their sexual conduct. At the very same time, as he says, of course I'm not talking about the unbelieving world. Of course you shouldn't withdraw from the unbelieving world.
Yeah.
And so, certainly with my living out hat on, I'm desperate to fight for the purity of the church on this issue, at the very same time as I want to tell Christians to go and get to know their gay non-Christian friends. Mm. I'm passionate about having a clarity about the difference there. And it seems to me, one of the lines I'll sometimes use is, as a church, our goal is to slightly baffle people. And so, you know, you take 1 Peter 2, we're to live good lives among the non-Christian world. I think our goal has to be to go out into the non-Christian world in such a way that people are slightly baffled by our view on sexuality and see it as outdated and old-fashioned. And you'd also notice our love and compassion and kindness, including to gay couples. And they're just mystified. How do you put those two things together?
Yeah.
We, as it were, we leave a great big question mark behind us. Okay, you're really old-fashioned on sexuality, and yet you're so kind and compassionate. How does that work?
That is the thrust, isn't it? It's interesting in 1 Peter. You know, we are in 1 Peter times, aren't we? We are strangers
absolutely
and aliens.
Yeah,
we always have been, I know, theologically. But we find ourselves more out of step with the world on these kinds of issues.
Yeah.
And so we do need to live differently, and we do need to expect that people will ask us to give a reason for the hope we have.
Absolutely.
You know, the way that evangelism seems to work in 1 Peter 4 is, you know, people living those distinct lives, baffling people. I like that idea, and people will ask questions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jesus is our best example on this. So as you look at the Gospels, I don't think you can get around the fact that Jesus has a really clear and might be perceived to be tight sexual ethic. He does define marriage as heterosexual, and that's before you get to gouging eyes out in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus has got a really tight sexual ethic, and yet obviously lives in such a way that you have tax collectors and sinners rushing to him and wanting to talk to him. And that you know, given that we have the Spirit of Jesus within us, that seems to me a really good goal for us, is to conduct ourselves in such a way that we have a really clear sexual ethic, and yet the extent of our love, compassion, interest in people is such that we're building relationships and, God willing, have the chance to answer questions.
That's really helpful, and we mustn't miss that piece out. I think we do, perhaps, when we're thinking about those who experience same-sex attraction, think, how do we care for our Christian brothers and sisters? We're going to come on to that now, but we mustn't miss out that other piece, that actually we've got a great gospel to proclaim to all kinds of people in all sorts of circumstances from all kinds of places. And that's really at the heart of reaching out with the good news, isn't it? So let's talk a little bit more, Andy, about how we can, in church, care for those who experience same-sex attraction. I'm getting it right, the experience same-sex attraction. And I guess one of the challenges is many of us will feel this is, it's not something I can identify with, resonate with. And so, you know, if I'm preaching and I'm preaching to someone who, you know, might be tempted, I don't know, to commit adultery or is tempted by lust, there's a sense in which I can resonate with that to a certain extent. I find it much more difficult to think about how to draw applications wisely, carefully, pastorally, sensitively in this area, I think.
Yeah.
I just feel at sea, to be honest.
Yeah, sure.
So just help me out here. How can I be a... I guess it's not just preaching, is it? It's pastoring more generally. It's caring for the flock. How do I, as a leader in the church, care for someone who is experiencing same-sex attraction?
Two or three things. So the first thing is to create within the church a culture where if somebody experiences that, they think this is a safe place to talk about it.
Okay.
And so I suspect most church leaders at some point over the next year are going to talk about sexuality, just because
of course,
it's around.
It's in the news. People are saying, you know, even if that's happening in another group of churches, what do you think about it? What are we doing? Yeah.
And so I, when I was a pastor, I developed basically a mantra. You know, I'm about to talk about sexuality. There are three things I want to say. Firstly, we hate homophobia. You know, we believe everybody is worthy of dignity
and
respect.
Just define homophobia for us, because that's a slightly slippery word in the world.
Yeah, no, it is. And what I define by homophobia is basically hating people, responding to them in prejudicial ways such that they don't have legal rights and so on.
Okay.
So basically treating people as less than made in the image of God in the way in which we speak about
it's quite
them.
Tightly defined.
Yeah.
But helpfully.
So maybe I wouldn't even use that language. Probably I would say, look, I'm about to talk about sexuality. The three things I want to say. I want to say everybody is made in the image of God and is worthy of dignity and respect in respect to their sexuality. Because of what Jesus teaches and because of the love story at the heart of the universe that leads to Christ and the church, I do believe that marriage is for a man and a woman, and that's the right context for sex. And if you've got any questions about that, or this is personal for you, please do talk to us. We want to talk about this. So pretty much every time I mentioned sexuality, I did those three things.
Right. Okay.
Here's why we believe what we believe. We think everybody is worthy of dignity and respect, and we want to talk about it. So part of it is just creating a culture where if somebody is experiencing same-sex attraction, they know they can talk to a pastor or somebody within the church. That's the first thing. Second thing is, just basic pastoral stuff. You're listening well. You're asking questions. How long, you know, has that been something since teenage years? Tell me what it was like to live as a teenager within the church wrestling with this. What's it been like for you? What are the times that are hard? Is there anything in this you're thankful for? Feel free to be honest. Where do you land biblically? Are you happy with where we are as a church? Is that something? So just basic pastoral stuff of listen, ask good questions. And then the pairing I often have in mind is temptation and suffering. So my experience of, you know, growing up experiencing same-sex attraction, you know, one level same-sex attraction is a temptation to engage in thoughts or behavior that is contrary to God's plan. So there's a temptation there. There's also a suffering element, to be honest. So discovering as a teenager, your sexual attractions are going towards, in my case, guys rather than women, praying that the Lord would take that away and it not changing across a period of time, it dawning on you, you're probably not going to get married and you're not going to have kids and stuff.
That's a kind of grief.
There's a grief there. Yeah, there's, yeah. You know, I remember a friend just really, Andy, you seem to be going through a kind of bereavement here. And that was just really helpful. Yeah. And certainly the pastors and friends who've helped me most over the years are those who've got that combination.
Right.
So they haven't just, right, let's bring up the accountability questions.
Yeah, okay.
Without a kind of, there's a degree of pain in this. But equally, they've not gone to the stage of empathizing with the pain such that they've suggested I discard biblical ethics. So those who've helped me most are the pastors who've got both of those elements.
I find that extraordinarily helpful. I'll tell you why, because I'm thinking as a married bloke. When I think in terms of sexual temptation, I'm thinking about swapping something that is good and holy for something that is not. That's the temptation. It's very real.
Yeah.
But it's not loss.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's misplacement.
Yeah.
And what you're describing to me is grief and bereavement. That's a different category. And I think that's really, really helpful. Not least because, as it happens, I don't think the church knows how to deal with bereavement very well.
I think that's probably right, actually. Yeah.
I think the church is basically deals with bereavement in a sort of virulent way. We'll meet again. Don't worry. It will be okay. And I don't think that's a biblical way to deal with bereavement. So it's interesting that there's a, although that's a very different subject, we need to do some podcasts on that, that actually there is a failure to deal with bereavement well in that area probably hinders us in dealing with essentially what is grief and loss, actually in lots of areas of life. You know, for a couple who can't have children, for someone who is experiencing same-sex attraction, for someone who can't get a job, you know, there are different kinds of grief and loss. But actually, just generally, I think we're bad at dealing with the disappointments of unfulfilled hopes and dreams. Maybe not hopes and dreams. That's not quite the way to describe it. But life not delivering what society or culture or church even seems to promises a kind of an ideal.
Yeah, that's right. And if people have adopted from culture, you're the main way to find joy and satisfaction in this life is to find your other half or your romantic partner. There's a huge amount of loss, in a sense, we're saying to people who experience same-sex attraction. 2 Corinthians has kept me going as a Christian, and it's pairings like sorrowful yet always rejoicing, having nothing and yet possessing everything. And and those sort of phrases just resonate with me hugely, because is there a sorrow in some of the choices that I've made which has meant no romantic partner, no children and all of those things? Yeah, of course there is. And yet,
always rejoicing.
Yeah, because in some ways, has it been the thing in my life the Lord has used to press me into knowing the Lord more? Certainly. Actually, as I've said no to a romantic partner, has that freed me up to pursue several deeply satisfying friendships at a depth I probably wouldn't have been able to otherwise? Yeah, absolutely. And so maybe to add to my pair, it's temptation, it's suffering, and yet also reasons for joy as well.
You said right at the beginning, you describe yourself as a Christian who experiences same-sex attraction and the importance of the order of that, rooting your identity in Christ. I wonder if one of the other ways we don't really help lots of people in church, but actually especially in this area, is that when it comes to same-sex attraction, we do make it the thing to be talking about and fighting and battling and wrestling with and all those sorts of verbs. Whereas in fact, we're all complex individuals.
I'm sure.
Facing temptations of many kinds.
Yeah.
And lots of various trials and difficulties, to use a Bible phrase. And actually, this isn't just the thing, is it?
No, absolutely.
And is there a danger that actually we do make it the thing in the way that we talk about it, the way we provide care?
Yeah, definitely. And again, this is where just the pastoral work of listening is so important, because people's stories will be different. And probably actually, as I reflect on my life at times, amongst the sort of challenges, the battle, same-sex attraction has been the thing. In other stages of life, it's pretty much in the background. And the challenge has been more finding identity and work and so on. And so, yeah, there will be a whole heap of different aspects to people's lives such that it won't be the thing, except actually probably in certain stages of life it will be the thing. And so that's just the pastoral care needed to listen to people's stories. Yeah. Wow.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about living out. Mm. Didn't want it to be an advert for living out, but you're doing some great work. Bless you for that. You know, it's really helped the church, I think.
Encouraged by that.
How can living out help churches in the FIC think about this? What kinds of resources, what kinds of opportunities are available to tap into?
Two or three things we do. So I do think our website is really good. Most of it isn't written by me, so I can say that. But most apologetic questions, most pastoral questions, there will be an article about it somewhere on the Living Out website. So if you've got a question linked to sexuality, seeing where there's an article there might be the first way to go about it. One resource we've particularly put together for church leaders is we have a 10-point living out audit, which, again, I didn't write it, so you don't have to like it, but it's designed to be...
Do I have to like everything you've actually done then, Andy? I said,
yeah, no, okay. It's, well, quite. But it's, we use it as a language to sort of how biblically inclusive is your church? And so it will have stuff like, how do we value marriage and singleness equally?
Right.
Does your church function as a family so that those who choose not to have a nuclear family, perhaps out of loyalty to Jesus' teaching, nevertheless are wrapped up within a church family? Are actually all of us as Christians carrying crosses in different areas of life, not just in the area of sexuality? So we have this 10-point biblical audit, which I think is quite a useful resource. We've got a podcast, which, again, if you want to listen to three or four of those...
Not yet available in video.
No.
Like the excellent Independence
podcast. I mean, I've had to have a haircut, especially because this is in video. But yeah, if you want three or four people who experience same-sex attraction but wanting to live in line with Jesus' ethics, just talking about what it's like, that's, I think, quite a useful resource. And then we aim to do events where we teach into this, both three areas we try and teach into: biblical material, cultural material, how do churches pastor people well. So we run a series of events around the country. We're always looking for churches who want to host us to do that. So those would be the main resources we do.
And it does seem to me we need to affirm Christians who are facing all kinds of temptations, seeking to live godly, Christ-like lives, don't we? So I think one of the great things we can do as pastors is affirm and encourage and, you know, say to people in any context, when they seek to live for Christ, even when that's countercultural, even when that's difficult, say, bless you, brother.
Yeah,
bless you, sister, for doing that.
I think that's right. I mean, I remember, obviously I've been talked about it very publicly over the last 10 years, but I remember the sort of slightly excruciating conversations with friends in the early years when, you know, I began to talk about this being part of my experience. And I remember one, actually an FIC pastor, actually, who just said to me, Andy, that must be really hard, but the fact that you want to live for Jesus, I can just see so much evidence of the Spirit at work in you at the moment. To be honest, I hate passing on stories like that. But actually, just as a really good model of encouraging somebody who's wanting to live for Jesus, and there's a degree of sacrifice involved in that. That was just a statement. Well, I remember the conversation 15 years old.
Yeah,
so
there you go. Yeah. Andy, thanks so much for joining us. We'll put the link through to Living Out. Just one extra question. I'm springing this on you, so you might not be able to answer this straight away. Books that are useful for people to tap into, that would be useful for a kind of a congregation to read, congregation member. Are there some good books? Sam Albury's Is God Anti-Gay? Yep. Just been reissued, I think.
Yeah, it has.
Updated. Good Book Company. Other things that people could look at?
Yeah. I book that's just come out, and it's largely because the issue of sexuality is so tightly linked to identity. So Andrew Bunt's book, Finding Your Best Identity, really short, would be great for teenagers, actually, but also for older folk. I still think Ed Shaw's The Plausibility Problem is a superb book linked to just how you get a church culture that helps same-sex attracted people.
Which ultimately is the answer to our question. You know, how do leaders care for those who are experiencing same-sex attraction? The answer is leaders care for people in any walk of life by leading the church into a healthy church culture.
Yeah, that's right.
Where there is a caring environment.
Yeah, and I still think Ed's book is superb on that.
Great. We'll put some links in the show notes and you'll be able to click through on those and buy them. Andy, appreciate you coming. I realise it's a very personal subject to be talking about, so thank you very much for your honesty. I've really benefited from that. Thanks for joining us on the Independence Podcast. Do rate and review, please, if you've enjoyed listening, and we'll catch up with you soon.